This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
First, let me say thank you so much for coming. This is actually the second in a series of talks on the future of theory. The first consisted of Jean-Michel and Greg Lambert, and tonight we have Jean-Michel again, Dorothea Elkowski, and myself, and Dorothea will be the main player here. I'm hoping that everyone is vaguely familiar with Dorothea and certainly familiar with Jean-Michel. Jean-Michel obviously teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, but Dorothea has been here to my count like four or five times now, so she's an absolute regular. But nonetheless, she deserves an introduction. Perhaps people know her best from her most recent book, which is Deleuze and the Ruin of Representation. But Dorothea has been working on philosophy and on non-Deleuzians for many years. She's edited two books, Merleau-Ponty, Interiority, Exteriority, and Psychic Life in the World, as well as Resistance, Flight, Creation, Feminist Enactments of French Philosophy. And she has a forthcoming book that we're going to get a little bit of a preview today on the question of love. As for Jean-Michel Robertet, I'll make it short and sweet because everyone really knows what Jean-Michel is up to. His most recent book is The Future of Theory, though he has in the past edited books, The Cambridge Companion to Lacan. He's also produced a book called Jacques Lacan, Psychoanalysis and the Subject of Literature, as well as Lacan in America. So we have two very, very different sort of trajectories into the question of theory today, and I hope that we're going to be able to sort of bring those out. But for the time being, we're going to begin tonight's festivities with Dorothea reading a text, and then we're going to segue into questions, a series of questions Jean-Michel and I have, and then I'm hoping that you will be able to ask some questions, especially of Dorothea, who is our guest, but really of the panel in general. So without further ado, let's begin.
Thank you, Greg. The reason I have this text to read is because I asked Jean-Michel, well, what do we do? And he said, send me some pages. So I sent him some pages, and it turned out to be a sort of five-page text, which is about all you can probably stand anyway, especially at this point in the day. It's called Love of One's Own. So I'll just read that first, and then we'll go from there into questions. From Plato to the present, love of one's own has been discouraged by philosophy. In the Republic, Plato argues for a city in which all women shall be wives in common to all men, and no woman shall live privately with any man. Men and women will live and eat together. No one will have private property, and nothing will be one's own. Nonetheless, what cannot be taken away and held in common is the so-called inborn necessity to have intercourse with one another, a necessity which, as Glaucon quietly reminds Socrates, is not mathematical but erotic, and therefore stronger in persuading and compelling the mass of people than any mathematical or rigorously dialectical formulations. Socrates, who has professed a certain lazy-mindedness toward his own proposal, passes over the question of what is possible and momentarily permits himself to assume that what he desires is available. And what he desires is to prohibit promiscuity as impious and to remake marriage as sacred as possible, recognizing that sacred means beneficial not to one's own but to the city. Therefore, only after their childbearing years will the inhabitants be allowed to indulge in their own pleasures. Only after serving the city will they be free to have intercourse with whomever they wish. Even so, that inhabitants will be allowed to indulge in their own pleasures seems less and less likely, because common feelings of pleasure and pain bind the city together, while isolated and private feelings dissolve the city's unity. In the city, words like mine and not mine and another's are particularly problematic. Pain and pleasure must be shared, such that whatever happens to a single citizen, good or bad, must be shared with the entire city. Commensurate with the sharing of women and children will be the prohibition on private houses or land or any type of private possessions, since one man calling anything his own not merely private possessions, but also wives and children, would instantiate private pleasures, private pains, private events. Individuals can own nothing but their own body. Everything else will be held in common, sparing them the dissension that comes with possession, especially the violence and anger which arise from personal disputes over ownership. The prohibition on one's own promotes a stable and moderate life, Plato concludes, and it is the path to happiness. It is certainly ironic that Plato posits the prohibition on one's own as his own desire, since this seems to break his own rule against asserting that anything, even an idea, is mine or one's own. Thus, he must also address what is possible. If the rule against one's own is not merely his, but is in some sense common, Plato has to show in what sense this rule is common and in what sense it is not merely his own desire. This means that, with reference to the inborn necessity of men and women to have intercourse with one another, including that of men and women with women, he must not merely calculate how to persuade or compel the mass of people to obey the rulers and to leave aside their own pleasures and pains. He must also address the erotic aspect of this necessity, and he does this in the Symposium. The lover who loves the beautiful or the good appears to desire that they become his own, since possessing the good or the beautiful makes one happy. But Diotima is made to caution Socrates. She's made to argue that no one takes joy in what is his own, but only in what is good, that love is wanting to possess the good forever. This is apparently achieved by a singular means. That means is to give birth in beauty, whether in body or soul. Why birth? Because it goes on forever, and love wants to possess the good forever. But the possession of what goes on forever cannot be a personal possession. It cannot be one's own. Nothing that is one's own goes on forever. Not only the body, hair, flesh, bones, and blood, but soul too. Manners, customs, opinions, desires, pleasures, pains, fears. None of this remains the same. To possess something that goes on forever, mortals must turn to the sphere of what is immortal, and therefore never one's own. And this sphere is accessible through love. So a quote from the Symposium. A lover who goes about this matter correctly must begin in his youth to devote himself to beautiful bodies. First, if the leader leads aright, he should love one body and beget beautiful ideas there. Then he should realize that the beauty of any one body is brother to the beauty of any other, and that if he is to pursue beauty of form, he'd be foolish not to think that the beauty of all bodies is one and the same. And when he grasps this, he must become a lover of all beautiful bodies, and he must think that this wild gaping after just one body is a small thing and despise it, end quote. So having turned away from the love of one body, the lover is freed from the threat of seeking to make that body his own. And rather than attending to his own love and the body of the beloved, the lover turns to souls, seeking to give birth to ideas rather than to the beauty of the singular body of the beloved. In fact, the beauty of bodies is relegated to a thing of no importance. The lover gazes not at the body of the beloved, but at activities and laws, customs and knowledge, in order to give birth to glorious and beautiful ideas and theories, loving now not out of his erotic necessity, but loving wisdom. This is the final love of what, quote, neither comes to be nor passes away, neither waxes nor wanes, end quote, and so can never be made one's own. This love is a movement upward. By loving correctly, one is led to the final and highest mystery of love, that love of the absolute, pure, unmixed, and unpolluted by mere human flesh, the great nonsense of human mortality, that love of divine beauty, that mystery of love which turns away from the single beloved body in search of unpolluted beauty. In all of this, the question of what is one's own has seldom, if ever, been asked. Plato implies that love of one's own is the greatest danger of all for the city. Although Glaucon suggests that there might be an erotic necessity among men, it appears to me that this is less and less likely. One's own desire and one's own love appear to be easily foregone, victim of desire itself, which moves from one body to another, facilitating comparisons and the search for unpolluted beauty. In fact, Plato is little worried about desire and the love of one's own because he knows that the soul's trajectory is inevitable. It is written on the soul whose tripartite form of appetites, doxa, and intelligibility guarantee that the individual will be driven beyond love for his or her own body and beyond the desire to make the beloved body of the other one's own. Even degeneracy is not love of one's own, insofar as no aspect of the soul, not even its appetitive nature, leads the soul first to its own body and then to the loving adoration of the body of another. To be degenerate, to be a glutton or a sexual adventurer, is not to love one's own body nor the body of the other. The great mysteries of love are not love at all. Women and men love their own bodies and the bodies of others so little that they must be tempted into giving birth by the promise of beauty, the promise of honors, or the promise of wisdom, the highest mysteries. Love of appetite, opinion, or wisdom is not love, but the inevitable trajectory of the soul. Love would demand that it is possible to have something that is one's own, that there is a truly erotic necessity, but none ever appears in Western philosophy. Drowned in appetites, goaded by honors, or transformed by wisdom, there can be for us no love of one's own. Let us then begin by asking, what does it mean to love one's own, and why does Socrates make Diotima, a woman, the source of these ideas? Love of one's own would begin with love of one's own self, one's body and soul, in Plato's formulation, or in contemporary terms, one's body and the consciousness which exists this body and recognizes that it is nothing but the body. Passing over the body is passing over what is one's own in the most deeply personal sense, insofar as it is through this body that anyone is and can be connected with the world. One's own is first experienced as something felt. Without affective connections, there is no experience of one's own, and certainly no relation to an other that could be made one's own. What are affective connections? The caress, in its profusion of forms, the caress which shapes one's own body and shapes the other as one's own. The greeting, hands raised, hat doffed, eyes wide open, head nodding. The glance to the shoulder, the eyes, the neck, the thigh. These are among the more obvious forms, but there are many, many more, most of which are barely registered most of the time. Barely registered because we do not have a language which expresses them, nor a philosophy which acknowledges them as the condition of the possibility of all life, all desire, all thought. Affective connections are truly the most one's own. In order to open ourselves up to them, we must first subject ourselves to all the elements, all the milieus in the world, and to all the motions emanating from them. And in so doing, we become our own bodies. We feel our own bodies as motions. The warm sun shines, and we feel the heat of our skin. A jet takes off over our heads, and we cover our own throbbing ears. Bright lights flash along with strong rhythms and beats in a dance club, and we jolt our bodies around the room. The caress does not seek mere contact. We place our body against another body. We subject ourselves to our own affectivity in order to touch the body of another, in order to caress one's own body with her body or with his body, her flesh, his flesh. But philosophers, avoiding one's own, do not think about these things. Perhaps only a woman, a feminist by definition, could recall the caress, the entire realm of one's own, and question the philosopher's soul. A priestess engaged in ancient Greek rites would subject herself to the caress of the gods. She might find the path of the high mysteries unintelligible. She might instead have questioned the condemnation of one's own, not on the level of knowledge and not on the level of honors or appetites, but certainly on the level of affective sensibility, where to embrace one's own is to embrace all the beings and becomings of the world.
Thank you very much, Dorothea. After this beautiful fragment, we are going to read a few questions. I have to say that Dorothea didn't know anything about these questions 2 hours ago. So this is really improvisation. We're not rehearsing anything. I just read them very rapidly to her on the phone as she was arriving in Philadelphia. And she has, of course, she's totally entitled to say, another question I pass, and so on. So we're going to read them alternately, and we both wrote them, so we read each other's questions as well. And we decided to begin with a sense of background and the general outlook of Dorothea's philosophy, and then the questions will move to something that will return to the particular matter at hand, that is the reading of Plato and the issue of love. So I read the first question. Dorothea, even before your engagement with Deleuze, or at least at the same time, your work concerned Merleau-Ponty and the phenomenological tradition. I wonder if you might talk about your entry into the society of phenomenology, by which I mean not only the actual society, but more generally, the predominantly male world of continental philosophy and phenomenology.
And as stupid as this may sound, I think I was very lucky in that for a long time I didn't realize it was a male world. I just didn't pay attention. That was probably because even though I was reading texts written by and large by men at that time, I'm thinking back to graduate school, right? I probably never really addressed them the way I was supposed to. I was supposed to be a scholar, and I failed miserably at this. And I decided it was much more interesting to read things by connecting one text to another, one set of ideas to another. And it was only much later that I was informed, or I gradually learned, that this was not a scholarly methodology, at least not according to the people who were attempting to teach me scholarly methodologies. And so I think that part of my fascination with this material came from not realizing that it was supposed to be something different from what I thought it was. And I really thought you could just connect anything to anything as long as you had a connection. And so I did.
Thank you.
I wanted to sort of piggyback on this question and to begin to ask or to make it clear for the audience that for better or worse, Dorothea is one of a still select group of women working on Deleuze. In your last book, Deleuze and the Ruins of Representation, which I recommend heartily, it's a wonderful book, you mentioned the vagaries of the reception of Mille Plateaux, Thousand Plateaus, which seems to have skewed towards male scholars in both the United States and France. While you have argued that this should not be the case, perhaps you can speculate about why the feminist potential of Deleuze's philosophy was and is so delayed, and why you specifically decided to engage with Deleuze.
Well, female philosopher is an oxymoron, of course. And so that's part of the challenge. What interests me in both my work and in the texts I read, and in also in the social arena and the political arena, is when someone tells you that a certain thing is the way it is. This is how it should be understood. This is the right understanding. This is a field for a certain kind of thinker. Then that's immediately what I want to look at. And because I know they must be wrong. I know there's some weakness there. You know, anywhere there's a joint, anywhere there's a corner, it can always, the frame can always be taken apart. That's Barth's idea, of course. And it's from Barth that I really learned that. And so it seemed to me that at the time I started reading Deleuze, of course, no one had really taken it over yet. In my recollection, there was myself and there was Bundus, Constantine Bundus. Mm-hmm. And we were the only ones we knew about. For years, we would go to conferences and we would give papers and there would be four people, most of whom were graduate students, most of whom hadn't read Deleuze. And this went on for years and years and years, to the point where when actually it got to be the case that there were more than four people in the room, we felt very uncomfortable. And we decided that, you know, maybe it was time to find something else. So we still work with Deleuze, but I think we have moved on.
Okay, maybe connecting this with the very title, which is perhaps a little enigmatic, Gilles Deleuze and the Ruin of Representation. Could you explain simply this title and why do you feel that in connection with your feminism you think that there is something in representation that is a form of oppression? Why is representation as such oppressive?
Well, to put it perhaps in the most succinct, there are many, many ways to address the problem of representation, and it's not, you know, it's not a simple thing that I can deal, that I can address with. But the fastest, quickest way to access representation is to say that it's commensurate with whatever is habitual. So habituation and repetition of something that is habitual is representation the way I'm defining it in this text. And so what I'm interested in untying, undoing, ruining are any conceptual, structural, organizational methods or orders which are established on a habitual basis, purely habitually. And this usually operates this way because it's something that functions very nicely for somebody, somewhere, somehow, but not necessarily for me, and not necessarily for the kinds of ideas, for the creation of new ideas. And so that's why I want, that's why I addressed representation. It's another word for habit.
Okay, that I think makes things very clear, a Bergsonian term, something. Thank you.
This is the most risky question of the bunch, and Dorothy has every right not to respond. But I think that the minute that I heard that you were going to speak on love today, I immediately and perversely thought of the opening pages of your last book, Deleuze and the Ruin of Representation, which partly consists in a discussion of Catherine MacKinnon's analysis of the regime of representation. And it's clear to me from those opening pages that you sympathize with MacKinnon's critique. But I wonder, in light of this work on love, what you make of her stand with Andrea Dworkin against the publication of pornography. And it's a stand that, I mean, certainly, for those who know MacKinnon, it has not had an incredible forcefulness in the United States, but it has a forcefulness in terms of changing the law in Canada. And I don't want you to speak politically so much as I want to ask, how do we distinguish between the actualization of the erotic and the kind of pornography that degrades femininity? Is it not a certain kind of degradation, or what we might better call sadism, which is integral to erotic experience?
That's a book. a couple of quick things. I really feel sorry for MacKinnon, perhaps in part through her own doing. She got mired in this stuff, You know, she's really mired in it. She doesn't know whether she wants to be doing philosophy or changing laws. And not that you can't do both, but she's really stuck deep in a pit. And I don't really want to go there at the moment because it's not a pit I'd like to climb into. Very briefly, I would say that pornography is representation, is habituation. And that's why it's so reprehensible, because it's completely non-creative in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. Yep. Maybe to enlighten your terms, I'll just broaden it a little bit and ask you about, since we're in the gallery, your engagement with art and artists. In your books, you devote a lot of space to consideration and discussions of Mark Kelly. You discuss Bill Viola, Michel Tournier, among others. In your mind, what is the relationship between philosophy and art? And would you risk saying with Nietzsche that philosophy must be evaluated in light of art and art in light of life?
Sure. Yes.
Good.
Moving on. I think we're going to move to a broader series of questions now. Beyond the book, and more in relationship to your work with Bergson, which remains, to my mind, completely unique in contemporary philosophy. I don't think that anyone else has really attempted a kind of Bergsonian feminism, or attempted to read Bergson through a feminist lens the way you have, and it's a striking synthesis. But I think it's also especially strange insofar as Bergson's vitalism was, during his own lifetime, recruited as part of a natalist movement in France that attempted to address population decreases and to sustain the idea of the French nuclear family. With that in mind, to your mind, is it possible to say that Bergson has ironically been posed himself as a false problem for philosophy? And how do you conceive of your own work as intervening in Bergsonism?
That's a nice phrase, that Bergson is a false problem. When I read Bergson, I'm also reading Irigaray. The two are as intertwined for me as any two could possibly be, if I have to put a name on it. And the reason I don't care about all that vitalism is because I told you I was a really bad scholar. And I continue to be deliberately blind to the scholarship. I don't care. It's really, for me, a question of what I can make of it by connecting it with other ideas. And so, and I also want to say that I'm aware that my so-called reading of Bergson is not very Bergsonian. Perhaps my reading of Irigaray isn't not very Irigarayan, but I don't care about it either, because once again, I'm interested in what kinds of new ideas can emerge from connecting, from connecting ideas. So, in Bergson, of course, it's obviously this idea of the durée and of some which allowed me to think about affectivity for the first time. I didn't find that in 20 years of doing Merleau-Ponty. I never found anything about it in there. And it first brought it alive for me. And I want to be clear at the start, before we get confused, that affectivity is not emotion. So I'm not talking about emotions, which are, as far as I'm concerned, as trite and habitual as any other form of life that is trite and habitual. But actually, affectivity as this, the influence of the motions of all the entities, agents, objects in the world on one another. And so even though Bergson himself actually addresses this very little, it allowed me to begin to think about it and to open up that whole sphere of thinking.
Great. I mean, what's amazing is that you've answered to the next question,
good,
which I will then skip, show that we have similar lives. So the questions now, we'll focus a little more on the question of loving oneself or love on one's own. And it goes back to feminism. The gentle or angry claim that women should be entitled to an X of their own, X standing for a room, a body, a sexuality, and so on, has often been taken as a staple feminist motto. Having worked on Max Stirner's The Ego and Its Own, and its critique by Marx and Engels in the German ideology, I'd like to have your opinion on this issue. Can one speak of being one's own or of loving one's own love without having to take into account the hard economics of ownership? How much is love dependent upon the foundational concept of propriety that, for instance, anarchists would, of course, criticize or debunk? This is the Marxist moment.
Yes, I can tell. I do have some ideas for working towards some politics at the end of this. I'm interested in working toward a politics. But I'm so completely discouraged by everything I read, absolutely everything, that I've really come to the conclusion that it needs most of it to be tossed away. And when I say one's own, and the reason I began thinking about one's own is because precisely it was one of those points where I kept seeing again and again, one's own is contrary to social and political norms, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, well, that must be the place to go because this is the forbidden corner. So let's exactly go to that forbidden place and see what's there. In doing that, then I have to say one's own is not about ownership. It is not about propriety and property. It's in the beginning, it's about this affective element in the sense of paying attention to one's own pleasure and pain, which is certainly something you cannot possess, nor can you buy it, nor can you sell it, nor can you own it in any traditional sense of the word. But paying attention to pleasure and pain, which is something we absolutely refuse to do in this society, as far as I can see, or perhaps almost any society. We do not pay attention to pleasure and pain. So what I'm trying to do is to begin there by drawing attention to that. That's what I mean by affectivity, by the way. Nothing more. Pleasure, pain. That's all. Just trying to start there.
Now we're going to move very briefly to the tender region of psychoanalysis, just for a moment. Freud's model of sexuality leaves an important place to autoeroticism. One might almost say that autoeroticism is the paradigm of all subsequent libidinal developments. The little infant who discovers the lips as an erogenous zone seems to be saying, according to Freud, quote, "What a pity that I can't kiss myself," unquote. But last night, I must say that I was watching TV, and there was a moment during a television show where I heard someone say that Freud had once explained asthma as an attempt to call out to his parents, or to her parents, which I've never heard, so. Now, this insight may be read in two ways. Either there is a core of masturbatory self-sufficiency before the drive intervenes to send the child searching for other types of objects that will only replace it, or there is a constitutive deficience in our libidinal development in which the parts of the body selected by our drives eternally remain parts. In brief, what I have in mind here is how much do we need to believe in a whole body as our own body in order to speak of love of one's own body? In other terms, what happens when I am loved for a part of my body or when I love just a part of someone else's body and not, quote, the whole person, unquote?
This is one of those trick questions. First of all, paying attention to one's own pleasure and pain is not necessarily autoeroticism. Okay? Part of the problem as I see it is that even something like autoeroticism has come to be defined by a certain nexus of habitual activities. I think that Beauvoir, Sartre are right when they say that we only exist in situation, and that is, we only exist insofar as the other acknowledges us. And that's the starting point. So I never understood why one would follow Freud in his thinking that we start somehow with this little id. Melanie Klein, in her description of the infant's partial objects, is absolutely right. They're partial for a reason. It's an infant. It's not developed. It's unintegrated. It's that's all it has available to it. And it is the case, I have argued and would continue to argue, that were adults to have to exist that way, they would simply blow apart. They don't have the stamina. So it's not autoeroticism. It's pleasure and pain. That's a start.
Great answer. We're moving a little bit closer to Plato, and we noted that in the few pages you read, you started by quoting Plato's Republic and then moved on to the Symposium. Leo Strauss, in a seminar that has been rediscovered recently, presents the Symposium as a key to Plato's entire political theory. Would you also say that there can be no political theory of the ideal state that would not be at the same time a politics of love, or whether this term politics of love is simply to be avoided?
Yes, let's avoid it. particularly anything that comes from Leo Strauss. Obviously, I don't have to say this, but there's the entire politics. The politics takes over, there's no love. That's what happens. The politics takes over, and there's absolutely no love. There's no desire. There's no attention to one's own. It all becomes a question of finding a way to control the masses, feeding them noble lies so that you don't have to actually educate them, so that you can feed them symbolism rather than concepts, ideas, so that they respond in habitual ways, so that they're easier to control. Pleasure and pain would be far too direct. That would be Artaud's route, right? Not Leo Strauss's.
Okay, I'm going to shorten your question here significantly. When Socrates asserts confidently that all men, quote, desire their own good, Diotima is more skeptical. Then why, she replied, are not all men, Socrates, said to love, but only some of them? Whereas you say that all men are always loving the same things. If you had to give an answer to that question, which Socrates avoids, what would you say?
I have to read the question
again. It's a strangely worded question.
Why are not all men said to love? Well, because that's just the peculiarities, it seems to me, of the dialectic, of how the dialogue is working out. The question is, is love some sort of universal principle or not? Or is it only applied to a narrow segment of things? Mm-hmm. So I suppose that's the question, you know. I guess, at least to start, I'd like to keep politics out of love and love out of politics. I'd like to start there. And I don't want to have to go to, and I also want to avoid completely that dead end of public-private. It gets you absolutely nowhere as far as I can see. Everything I've ever read about public-private leads just to a stop sign. So part of the problem is even conceiving of any of this in Platonic terms. I think one has to read Plato in order to know what not to do.
Going back to the symposium still, and not in Leo Strauss's terms, I've often been wondering how should we assess the Tima's speech? Should we take it as somehow embodying Plato's theory about love? I was thinking of Lacan's different reading in the seminar on transference. For Lacan, the person who articulates the most crucial insight about love and desire is not Diotima, not Aristophanes, who is quoted by Freud. Aristophanes is a strict Freudian, but Alcibiades, precisely because he disrupts the order of the speeches about love. As we know, Alcibiades comes at the end, and his unruly intervention aims at praising Socrates with a very practical goal in sight, that is, he wants to seduce Agathon by showing that Socrates is in fact not a real lover, not a sexual lover. This double-edged praise of Socrates, nevertheless, allows Lacan to introduce his theory of the agalma, the hidden treasure concealed underneath the rough exterior experience of Socrates, and for Lacan, discloses the very important function of an object, that is, the object of desire. Without reopening the entire file of Lacan's theory of love, how would you theorize in your own vocabulary this important relationship between love and desire?
The last time I taught the symposium, all my students were totally fascinated by Alcibiades. At least half of them wrote about it, which surprised me because I really hadn't spent that much time on it. It surprised me that they had. I think it's a ruse. It's a ruse to draw you back into the structure of the symposium. It's very clear throughout Plato's work that love is a disruptive, even violent force that is necessary in order to bring you from the gluttonous, appetitive soul through your beliefs, where you have a right opinion, if you're lucky, to the level of the highest appreciation of the good, the beautiful, the true, and the just. And while Alcibiades simply reintroduces that energy at the end of a very serious, very high-minded, spiritual discussion, which of course is put in the mouth of a woman, and reintroduces that so-called erotic energy, but it's still part of the game. It's still part of the Platonic structure. To me, it doesn't lead anywhere outside.
Okay. In part, you've answered this final question, but I'm going to pose it anyway, just because I know that you insist that we need to return to Plato in order to know, in a sense, not what not to do. But I think there's also a movement that Jean-Michel has pointed to in the past, especially represented by Alain Badiou, this movement to go back to Plato to find some kind of hidden truth that remains there. And I wonder if, in these general terms, you could talk about your own return to Plato and what you hope to get there.
I haven't returned to Plato.
Well, perhaps just in this single piece.
I know. I'm just being difficult. The reason I picked up the Platonic text is because when I'd actually been working almost exclusively with Irigaray and Sartre on these questions, and the last paper I gave on love was a reassessment of Sartre's analysis from an Irigaryan point of view, if you want to put names on it, just so that people don't squirm quite so much when I say Sartre. Okay. So I went back into this because the whole question came up of love being a spiritual phenomenon. And This is in Plato, it's the obvious place where love is excessively spiritualized, and people are fairly familiar with these texts. And I certainly am familiar with them because I've been teaching them for years and years and writing about them from time to time. It's, I guess, one reason I read these texts and is because, and I have this uneasy feeling that we have to sometimes look at how we got to where we are, what that pre-existing habitual structure is. The structure is so habitual that we don't even see it. And so sometimes it helps to go to someone like Plato, who's so clear and who lays it out for us in such plain terms that it's so easy to see the structure and to point out what the bad habits are and to see how love got to be something spiritual and how pleasure and pain were completely left out of the picture. It's not even that they're identified with the appetitive soul, they just totally eliminate it. They don't even exist. And then to try to find other ways to bring these, what I think are the crucial issues, back in. Mm-hmm. But to show that, you know, it's not that Plato was wrong, it's that he wasn't even addressing what we're trying to address.
I remember in a talk that you gave here a few years ago, you demonstrated very convincingly that Plato had invented film and that it took like 20 centuries to just implement the invention. Or am I misquoting you?
You are. Actually,
this
I think...
This is what I remembered.
Yeah, what I tried to argue was that this once again was the wrong place to go to look for film.
Okay, so.
And the reason I addressed it, right, was because this is where everyone thinks we should go, because that's where Althusser, that's where it got all picked up in the French tradition.
There is that line that Plato says that the world is a moving image of eternity, which is sort of gotten played out again and again in terms of analogies to film.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder at this point, having staked out some of this ground, that we might turn it over to others in the audience who might want to bring in some other questions. Where shall we begin? Ashley. Can people on the other side hear?
I'll repeat it,
okay.
if I can remember it. He's asking about Aristotle in the Ethics. Aristotle addresses...
He says that pleasure and pain are the criteria of our action. He says that pleasure and pain are what the entire study of ethics is concerned with. And it's not only that they tell us how to act and how we should not act, but they also play a role in facilitating acting ethically and achieving excellence.
This is a problem. For Aristotle, everything is about being moderate, you know, not too much. Well, this is not something you have any say over when it comes to pleasure and pain, you know. You can't determine too much or too little. And this is the wrong place to begin completely. And then to say, first of all, we're going to determine what is too much and what's too little, and then we're going to build an ethics on it, and then we're going to build a politics on top of that. This is, it's an impossible procedure, particularly if you also keep in mind that you don't exist until you are looked at from the outside. So somehow you have to balance the impossibility, right, of controlling or measuring the right amount of pleasure and pain with the view from the outside.
To elaborate a little bit more about this thing that you mentioned pain. Since then, since we, as we here in the present in the United States, that's seem to be paying attention to lean, to lean more than pressure on pain services, right? There is the whole industry of SoCal, diet, fitness clubs, and all that would seem to be geared to that.
I think that most of what that is about is cutting ourselves off from feeling anything completely, either through some concepts about the certain way to, about what it, you know, about concepts about meditation or controlling your body to a point where it does somehow what you want it to do, or it looks the way you want it to look, or it acts the way you want it to act. But people don't actually have any sensibility. They don't feel anything. I don't mean emotions. I mean they don't actually feel their own pain, and they don't feel their own pleasure. They don't, for instance, pay attention to when their throat is tight or they're not breathing well. They don't pay attention to how they're, the cramp in their thigh until it's so strong that their foot falls asleep. We pay very little attention to how we move through a room, virtually none. Every time I walk into a classroom, all the blinds are closed. You can't look out the window. What is it with these students of mine, right, that they don't even see that the blinds are closed and the room is dark and dreary? We pay no attention to any of this.
Okay, for those who cannot hear, the question is about the essence of jouissance, which Lacan says is pleasure, in which pleasure and pain are indifferentiated and not to be differentiated.
I found an analogy with this, that throughout a lot of contemporary philosophy, what's passive and what's active are undifferentiable. And even in physiology, it seems to me that a lot of physiologists do not differentiate between active and passive, because everyone knows passivity is bad, of course, right? This is very bad, especially if you're a feminist. It's the worst. It seems to me that that's part of the same nexus. No differentiation between pleasure and pain, no differentiation between passive and active. So some of the examples I gave had to do with things we don't normally associate with pleasure or pain, right? The glance or the raising of one's hand in a gesture to someone else, or simply how you widen your eyes in a greeting, or small gestures that are made all the time. Much of this is imperceptible. It's below the level of perception. We generally only pay attention to what we can perceive. What we can perceive is minimally a figure on a ground. It's defined by what we're interested in, because as you well know, that if you perceived everything in the room, you would probably just pass out because it would be so overwhelming. So you only actually perceive what interests you, what you're focused on, what your attention is directed towards. And perception even more is the ultimate goal of perception is action. We want to do something. We're so fascinated by the things we can do that we perceive for the sake of acting. So the whole passive element of the imperceptibles, what is below the level of perception, okay, that's what I'm interested in. Very subtle. part of my own little hole is the critique. I'm trained as a philosopher. Kiss of death, right? Because what do philosophers do? They take things apart. They analyze. No, I realize you're not, but this is why there are these strands that seem somewhat incommensurate. Okay. If I'm understanding you right. Okay, all right. All right. So part of what I always have to do, in order to be read at all by philosophers is to address philosophy, right? And so if I'm going to address philosophy, I'm going to just have to take it apart, pretty much. Sometimes I don't. It was pointed out to me recently, for instance, that I'm not particularly harsh on Deleuze, that I don't particularly take it apart. And that's true, I don't actually. But I don't necessarily, I don't interpret it either. That is, the Deleuze in my book isn't really, I mean, I don't know what it is, okay? Something. It's like, where does Deleuze tell me when he says some things, what do I hear, and where do I go with it, you know? The only thing I know about, I mean, one thing I know about him personally is that he kept telling people, oh, please, you know, don't get stuck in my stuff, go to your own. So there's always that whispering of go to your own. But within philosophy, you have to establish some framework, right? So you establish your framework by taking it apart. And then, to me, any creative act is a feminist act. Maybe that's simplistic. Well, this is what I'm saying. There are two things. First of all, it's the place where I'm told not to go, to go there, okay? And secondly, it's then to connect that place to other things in order to create something else. That's that those are the most abstract terms possible, but it's deliberate. Because if I don't express this in abstract terms, then I've prohibited my own free movements.
Maybe to connect this with a broader question, you mentioned Sartre, Irigaray, both have famously written maybe as much fiction or strange texts, hesitating in Irigaray's production. She's come back to philosophy, but for a while she would write these strange novels about philosophers. How do you see this, the need somehow to fit the definition of being a philosopher? Is it because you need somehow, you want to address a certain audience, or because there is a certain intellectual rigor there, or because there is a certain pleasure there, or all at once? In other words, why don't you write novels instead of writing these books on Deleuze?
I don't think I'm much of a novelist. But I think that, for example, the pragmatic aspect is when I wrote this book and I said, can I call it The Ruin of Representation? They said, no. You have to put Deleuze in the title.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's part of the game. But more and more I'm learning, because I'm being encouraged from a number of different directions to not have to do that anymore. I like to give people some frame of reference with something they can connect to, though. So I like to use some philosophy. I like to use some literature. Perhaps for me, an even more important figure has been Clarice Lispector, far more important than Irigaray in many respects on my own thinking and development for many more years than Irigaray. It's just that I was so immersed in Lispector's writing that I thought, well, okay, I'm going to read something else for a change. I also find it very hard to find interesting things. I know that sounds terrible, but you really have to search and search and search and search. And, you know, sometimes it's just luck that you find something that works. So I do think it's helpful to provide philosophical or literary foundations as sites for others to work with as well.
Since I have so many questions, I'm going to ask the simplest and the most lighthearted one. And in the context of what your readings were, you seem to be dealing with the topological extremes of love, hate, and I'm purposefully avoiding the term opposites, that is, the topological extremes are not necessarily the opposites. How would you, the question is rather simple, what would you say about loving or hating of the bad and the ugly as opposed to the good? Where is the hierarchy coming from?
Do you mean that love is good and hate is bad? Is that what you mean?
Well, that's in fact.
Right. But you know that everybody loves something that's not really beautiful, right? I mean, like children always have some sort of ugly stuffed animal that they absolutely adore, or some pet that's ugly as sin, and they'd love it. Well, just culturally ugly, habitually ugly. Okay. I think you point out something that probably needs to be looked at in terms of the tradition, that the habits that have been handed down to us And that's the tie between love and hate and the beautiful and the ugly. And it's not actually something I've looked at too carefully yet at all, but it probably would be an interesting place to go. I'm not even quite sure what to do with the question, to be honest with you, so maybe you thought it was the simplest one, but I didn't. To think about it.
Getting back to your pain and pleasure to this presentation, I'm not going to disagree that our culture has problems with engaging with pain and pleasure. And if our culture is going to engage with it, and if pornography is the most prevalent discourse or aesthetic of representation, then if pornography is reprehensible, then how can we engage?
I don't know that it's the most prevalent, that pornography is the most prevalent. I don't think pornography deals with pleasure or pain at all. Not at all. It deals with representation. Repetition of familiar patterns. I don't think things have changed much since what's-her-name Linda Williams wrote Hardcore.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty much the same. And there's a scenario, and in fact, for hardcore aficionados of pornography, if you deviate from the scenario, they don't want to see it.
That's why pornography produces more sequels than any other genre. It's true.
And that's why we say sequels that they're pornographic.
There's a new one in Dina Royale. She raises this so-called new pornography. How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, they've been doing that for quite a while. Sure, fine, you know. I hope they're making money. What I've seen of it, it's a little softer core. And not quite as scripted, but still pretty dull.
Yes.
Yeah, I just have a question. I'm a pretty big fan of the doctrine of meaning as a way of, as a paradigm for judging use of logic versus, I don't want to call it, sort of survivalist tactics in achieving a goal.
Got it, yeah.
Could you summarize again?
Say anything more about it? Well, it's thoroughly prescriptive, right? It tells you what you should do. And when you should do it and how you should do it. So that you don't have to, under the guise of rational reflection on means, I mean, what you get to do is you get to think about what the mean is. And because you get to do something, you feel as if you're an agent or as if you've actually played some role in this ethics. Because you get to say, okay, what's too much, what's too little, and then you get to figure out what the mean is. Well,
you're talking about from the doctrinal rules, like, I'm just talking from the personal paradigm. I'm looking back to, I really should assess that, right? You know, or wow, I think I'm overreacting to you if I just, you know, waited another minute and would come around with it anyway.
Well, that's a different question to me. Okay, that's not about a doctrine of means. That's a much more, to me, that's an interesting question because I actually can say something about that. it has nothing to do with any doctrine of means. It has to do with paying attention to one's own affective states and all of a sudden realizing that you're in a room full of people and you can barely breathe. Or that something you're doing is producing some sort of response from others that makes you, again, feel happy, joyous, or something else. You know, it's like I tell my students all the time, if you would just stop and tickle yourself a little more, you might actually be able to get in touch with this, you know, to think about this a little bit.
That's fine. I mean, maybe I just gave you too much of there, so that's kind of what I thought the doctrine was getting at. I mean, maybe.
No, it's a rational doctrine.
Pardon?
It's a rational doctrine. You have to reason between what's extreme on either end.
Right.
It's a rational doctrine. No. It's not rational, nor is it irrational. It's affective.
So, in addition to taking yourself off, how would you propose being mindful of what is the result?
Well, if mindful of it. You know, almost anything we would do would help. It doesn't take a lot. Kids do it all the time. And then we say, don't do that. Right? I mean, sometimes in class, I make my students hold their arms up until they're tired. Because this is much better than them falling asleep in the back row, right? Because they're tired. I think that, you know, what we do, it probably would depend on the circumstances. I'm thinking about it. I think we already do a lot of this all the time. We just don't pay any attention to it, okay? What can we do? Well, for one, I think we have to start talking about it because the habits that we have are the habits of a society that is focused on acting in certain ways, carrying things out, action for a purpose. We all know passivity is by definition evil and ugly. I'm beginning to get it. And I think we can't do anything until we start talking about it a little more, sort of, you know, guerrilla acts of affectivity aren't going to be enough. So we need to, so I would like to see it discussed without immediately being taken to, oh, we're talking about feelings in the sense of emotions. We're not. Okay, we're not talking about emotions. We're not sophisticated enough to even begin to talk about emotions because we don't know anything about our own pleasure and pain. And the emotions we think we talk about, we've just made this up. You know, completely made this up. It doesn't even exist. You know, because someone says to you, how are you? And what do you say? I'm fine. This is all made up. None of this is real. So I think that what I'm at least attempting to do is to begin to talk about this in a philosophical way, as well as find it in many other contexts. This is one of the values of artists who already do this, you know, a lot. Not all of them, but many of them do.
More important to look at repetition in the sense.
not sure I understand exactly what you mean by the history which produces them, because it could be that you're talking about something innate, or it could be that you're talking about something physiological, or it could be that you're talking about something that's socially constituted. Bodies remembering pleasure and pain. Certainly, as long as it's not a psychological memory, okay? I would be, I think that's part of the problem, is that it's all, it's reduced immediately, the idea of pleasure and pain is reduced to something psychological. It's not. If it is as I've articulated it or attempted to conceptualize it, it's the influence, right, of every agent and object upon any other. And this is why it's to a very large degree imperceptible. I think this is where I would say that insofar as there's a memory of it, first of all, it's ontological, not psychological, which means that it's constantly shifting, which would go back to the first part of what you said. At every moment that you focused on it and became aware of any pleasure or any pain, it would always be from a new point of view. Always. And everything would shift from the beginning to the end, and from to the past, towards the past, towards the future. A constant shifting from the point of view that you are in at that moment. I'm mixing three or four different kinds of language here because I'm hoping that one of them will resonate.
I think we're somewhat satiated at this point. So I'd like to thank everyone for coming, and to thank Dorothea for coming up from D.C. and from Colorado in general, and Jean-Michel. And thank you.